Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Poetry Salon Cast. I'm your host, Tricia Faye Hefner.
And I'm Callie Grace Thomas.
On each episode, we interview one of our favorite poets to ask what got them started writing.
And what keeps them going.
And my favorite question, what do they do with a rough draft that wants to play rough?
Then we ask for advice that we and you, our listeners, can use in our own writing practices.
Without further ado, welcome to this week's episode of the Poetry Salon Cast.
All right. Hello, Poetry Salon Cast listeners. Today we are going to be interviewing Nancy Linne Wu. Nancy Linne Wu currently has poems on display in the Billie Jean King Main Library in Long Beach, California, as part of the Between the Divide exhibition for 2019 Professional Artist Fellows. She has also had her poems on display in the Ruth B. Shannon Art Gallery in Whittier, California, as part of a multimedia project, Bridget. She was selected as an Emerging Voices Fellow with PEN America in 2015 and an Idlewild Writer Week Fellow in 2019. Nancy is the author of two chapbooks, Bearing the Juice of It All from Finishing Line Press 2016 and Rampant from Sadie Girl Press 2014. Thank you so much for being here. And I didn't realize until I read your bio that you were also an Idlewild arts writer. That's where I started really getting serious about writing poetry too. So we have a lot in common.
Yes, we do. And thank you for having me, Tricia and Kelly. I'm excited to be here.
So let's start off by listening to two of your poems, an easy one and a hard one. And don't tell us which one is which, and no need to give any introduction. Just take us away.
Alrighty. This first poem is called Yeah Yeah, Grandfather. He came here as cargo, a child, hot breath to feet, fish heads ripping off with teeth, an orphan to old Los Angeles. I do not remember his skin, deep brown before tanning beds, the color of immigrant sweat pickling in the sun. I do not remember his teeth yellowing in Chinatown, or any laundromats or fish cookeries or wonton soups he served. I remember no music and attended no funeral. By then, I was already wind. As a young man in 1945, the roots pulled him back across the Pacific. Spine reaching forward, sturdy as a clothesline. To himself, he pinned a bride and her large, proud family. They swayed their way to America, twisting in the wind like a question mark. Then we, my father, my mother, my sister, and me, were unhooked and left to drift away. Indefinitely, as if watching from a balcony, I wait to know what happens next. I wait to see if his face will appear or if I will remember anything. I remember some things, not from my cortex, but from the loose eye floating in the dumb of the ocean, turning, bobbing like a cork. I remember from a place where death is just another swell. I remember the blue and learning to hold my breath.
Gorgeous, thank you.
Thank you. All right, this next poem is called Times Like These, which is after Adrian Rich of a poem by the same title. Considering times like these, I imagine everyone wants a home. It's necessary to talk about home. Who has one? Who doesn't? A child in a motel room bangs a plastic cup against his mother's half-packed suitcase as gallons and gallons of milk curdle dumped. A migrant worker watches strawberries rot on the vine. Considering times like these, it's necessary to talk about how food grows in stalks, on trees, in bushes, underground where worms make magic of our scraps. Plastic boxes thrown from a White House window, littering the lawn with stripes. I think of Rome, as if they didn't know what was coming. I'm not sure the exact date the avalanche began its slow descent down the hill. Stupidity gathering steam fueled by greed. But certain homes are burning. Peace begins when the hungry are fed, and mountains of zucchinis are rotting quickly without a sales plan. A paper pyramid is a shape no human can live in, and it's necessary to talk about ditches in times like these. I look out my window and see a guard with a gun. We've seen this before, haven't we? The boots, the cracks in the floorboards, the bodies, and the unbelievable horror of a rifle in the hands of a man who has pledged allegiance to a flag he believes is unburnable. Considering times like these, it's necessary to talk about my nose, how I have the face of someone who could easily disappear in the middle of a sentence.
Wow, that was awesome. I don't know which one of those was the easy one, which one was the hard one, but I know which one was written more recently.
Yep.
Oh, that's such incredible work. Just so podcast listeners know, Nancy's been hosting this fantastic morning writing session, which you call Rise and Shine Writing. So I've been listening to your poems and your prompts for, I think, the last 12 weeks.
So once the pandemic became the alarm bells ringing real loud in the middle of March, I spent the next 2 weeks, like many of us, going through a series of emotions. And I decided that one thing I could do is to hold a space on Zoom for people to generate writing, because I fully believe that writing is a great way of processing emotions, getting clear, and being in community. So Rise and Shine started on April 1st as a part of National Poetry Writing Month for 30-30. So it just started as, we're going to write 30 poems in 30 days on Zoom at 8 o'clock in the morning for an hour. That's small, that's manageable. What occurred during that time was just such a phenomenal energy of writing, of thinking, of sharing with the people who are in the group that people wanted me to continue it. So I continued it in May, and we wrote for another 31 days. And so for 61 days in a row, we wrote a poem every day. I start with a grounding meditation, because part of my artistic philosophy is that the more grounded we are, the more we can explore those far reaches of our imagination and our experiences. So I start with a grounding meditation, and then I read an example poem to get our wheels turning, and then I give a prompt. It always begins with free writing, because I think one of the major misconceptions that people have about writers, that I had about writers before I started writing, is that you just kind of sit down and the brilliance just occurs. And I have since learned that there is so much that goes into the writing process that is not just writing. Obviously, reading and receiving information and talking. This is for all levels, anyone who wants to get those writing wheels turning. So the free write just is a brain dump. And then we move into the actual poetry prompt, which is only about 15 or 20 minutes of actually writing a poem. And it is incredible what emerges. That is Rise and Shine. It is donation-based, so there is no upfront cost to join. And at the end of the writing hour, whoever wants to stay and share their poems, it's just kind of an open floor. So I'm doing it Tuesdays through Fridays. at 8 o'clock in the morning. And I've actually been working with Tricia in the Poetry Salon so that a lot of people go to both of our workshops. I know the Poetry Salon is doing workshops on the days that I'm not.
I mean, me, I'm always trying to write in the morning and before the day steals my energy away. But sometimes it's really hard to just get yourself motivated.
It's been really grounding as we all lose our schedules. I want to start us out by asking the question that I always ask, which is, tell us a little bit about your origin story. How did you get started as a writer? And what's made you continue on with the journey?
Yeah, I love stories about how people become writers. Robert Frost said something, being a poet is a condition. I first realized this condition when I was 8 years old. I wrote a poem about elves for my fourth grade teacher. As a moment of gratitude, poetry was a way for me to express my gratitude. Throughout high school, I joined a secret internet message board for teenage poets.
And was That's awesome.
It was a secret little community that no one in my real life knew about. I actually went to an open mic in Orange, the Ugly Mug, which was happening when I was 16.
Shout out.
Yeah, what's up, Ugly Mug? Anyway, after college, I came back to Long Beach, and I actually just started meeting a whole bunch of real-life poets and seeing that there were real-life poets doing the real-life poet thing. That was the real start of my conscious decision to write poetry for the rest of my life.
But I love that. I think that poets have a tendency to be apologetic for themselves sometimes. So I love that directness and that commitment that I am going to write poetry for the rest of my life.
I have this magnet on my fridge that says, find something you like and do it forever. What better way to live your life?
I want to know a little bit about how you've decided to become a poetry mentor. Do you find that it helps enhance your own writing?
Similarly to writing, I've always been a teacher. I'm the older sister. I have older sister syndrome. And I was always the one in my neighborhood who was the oldest, taking care of all the kids, the babysitter. I was always a writing tutor. I was a writing instructor in college. Before teaching poetry, I always taught other things. So it's, I think, a natural part of who I am. My belief is I'm always trying to give back whatever I receive. Yeah, I just think teaching does enhance my own writing, because if you're leading a workshop, you're reading a lot of poems and you are talking about poetry all the time. And even in the generative workshops like The Rise and Shine, I actually get to be a participant in my own workshop, in that I am creating a prompt for other people to hopefully be inspired by. And I'm doing that to also inspire myself. So in the 61 days that I was leading, we're doing the Rise and Shine, I wrote 61 poems. So I consider that a win-win.
I think I've learned a lot, and I'm sure Tricia, you have too, about yourself as a teacher. I've learned who I am as a poet through who I am as a teacher of poetry. And I'm wondering, Nancy, what you have learned about yourself through teaching.
Wow, that's a great question. I think I've learned to be gentler on myself as a writer, because if I can give nurturing and encouragement and support to anyone in my workshops, I have to look at myself and be like, why am I being so mean to my own self then? Why am I telling my own self that this writing sucks, the little critic that always goes through your brain? I definitely feel like it's emboldened me and strengthened me to feel like if I can give that to others, I best be able to give it to myself.
Yeah, no, I totally hear you on that. Sometimes I'm like, didn't I just lecture my students about not being so hard on themselves? Oh, well, I'm an exception. I'm different. I can take this much criticism. You're terrible. You should not be allowed to write. Everyone else is allowed. You're having your license revoked.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. I feel like it's a constant battle, too. It's not like you ever get to the top of the mountain, then you build a cabin there and you live there permanently. Like, you're always climbing that mountain. You're always slipping backwards and then climbing back up again.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I envision a lot of my little critics as there's some goblins, and I just have to know that they're there. You know, I think of The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron, who's one of my major, major influences, and conceptualizing the critic as an entity, as a force that is not you necessarily, is not the ultimate truth, and being able to discern what the critic is saying. The critic does have a place, as we know, when it comes to tightening and revising and listening to what's not right in a poem. I think the critic and the muse are always battling it out in my mind. I personally love the muse way more than the critic, but there's a time and a space to consciously say, okay, critic, I'm going to let you in. I'm going to see what you have to say, and I'm going to implement what I think will make this poem better. And I'm going to discard all of the mean things you're saying about me personally.
So I want to actually go into a little switching of gears here. I'm curious, when you're not teaching a class, how do you usually begin a poem? And what's your poetic practice like when you're, I guess, out in the wild and unrestrained by your teaching schedule?
Yeah, so what I've learned about myself recently is that I am a person who really benefits from writing every day. Writing, I mean, a poem every day. I have tried this in the past. I had tried 30-30 before, and I'd always give up around like day 7 or 12 being distracted by life. It took me a while to realize, in fact, this is recent from the Rise and Shine group, I really need to be generating constantly. There is a lot in me to generate, and if I don't generate, honestly, this might sound melodramatic, but something inside me starts to die. So my writing process in the past has been to resist the writing every day, like thinking like, oh, I've got other things I have to do. I need to pay some bills. I'm not allowed to write every day. Are you crazy? But strangely, with this pandemic, that is the thing I've been doing.
Nancy, can you talk? I love that. And I am 100% team show up every day. And as someone who's working a lot of jobs, I'm always like, oh, I have this to do. Can you talk just a little bit about how you achieve the discipline to do that?
Yeah, I understand that. If you're going to look at the quantity of time that I have spent resisting writing every day and the quantity of time I have spent writing every day, the resistance, I'll just be honest, super outweighs the actual discipline. So I'm just trying to be real here. I also wear a lot of hats, manage a lot of jobs. I'm a freelance writer. I have done festivals, built websites, done copywriting, blogs, and this is a recent realization. I get to choose what I say yes to. That is where I think the origin of saying yes to writing every day has come from. And I'll just be honest, it was kind of something the pandemic sparked, because I actually lost the teaching job of being in the schools that I had. I lost some PR clients that I was doing events for. With that clearing off my plate, there was an opening for me to say yes to what I wanted to say yes to as an experiment. I believe everything is an experiment. It gives me a lot of freedom to move through my life without having to be perfect, because I am a recovering perfectionist. So seeing it as an experiment helped me get to the place of discipline, rather than being like, I have to do this every single day. Another little mind trick is, oh, I get to do this every single day. I'll be honest, I'm unpacking it myself right now too. Like, how do you get to this space of writing every day? And when I was in the Penn Center, Penn America's Emerging Voices Fellowship, we had these amazingly successful professional writers come in. And if there was one message that every single writer tried to really get across to us, it was write every day. And I was like, that's not real. That's impossible.
Like the tooth fairy.
Yeah. And I just wanted to say one more thing about this is a shift in mindset that I have recently gone through. Is just personally, I grew up with the scarcity mindset of being poor, being not having enough. And I've spent a lot of years trying to recondition that. Actually, what I think a lot of what we're talking about is reconditioning, reprogramming, deciding what we want to believe and then acting upon it. So deciding that I wanted to believe in abundance and how that takes many different forms and shapes, and letting go a little bit of the structure and the rigidity, which I'll be honest, my brain definitely likes to have. I love to color code, for example. I need to have some structure. And then just letting go of that and trusting there is enough. There is enough time. There is enough space. I have everything I need. And then moving into that space allows me the freedom and the security to say yes to something like a disciplined writing practice, because I definitely think that positive reinforcement is more effective than negative reinforcement. Anyway, clearly I love talking about this, so that is just a few things that I've been thinking about recently.
The Poetry Salon is on a mission to provide inspiration, education, and support to poets everywhere at a price that is truly affordable for all.
Together, we are building a thriving community where poets can learn, grow, and share their work.
Whether you are a beginning poet or already a published author, you can get prompts, rewrite strategies, and a warm, supportive place where you can share your writing with other poets online.
Visit thepoetrysalon.com to find out more and register today.
I would like to know a little bit about the two poems that you read at the top. Which one of those was the easy one? And can you tell us a little bit about the genesis of the easy one?
Okay. The easy one was the second one that I read, The Times Like These. Easy in the sense that it just appeared on the page, feeling pretty complete. I wrote that on April 17th, so that had 16 days of writing every day behind it. And I've actually calculated in the past how many crappy poems I need to write in order to get to what feels like a good one. Generally, I'd say my success rate is like 1 or 2 out of 10, which feels pretty good. It was easy in the sense that it was easy to generate. It was also difficult in the sense that I felt a lot of anxiety while writing it and reading it and when it first came out. Because I think sometimes when a poem that feels really resonant of deeply painful things that are also true, it floods my body with cortisol, you know, the stress hormone. I'd say that it was easy to generate, difficult to read. But yeah, it came out because I had been writing every day.
That is so funny that you talk about trying to come up with a statistical analysis of poetry. I actually find that super fascinating. Kind of wondering which of my poems were generated in coffee shops, which of them were generated at home, which of them were generated in the afternoon. Is that disheartening for you in any way? Like, hey, I wrote a really good one yesterday, so probably the next 9 days, they're going to be really crappy. How does that work for you?
I'll be honest, yes. And in the past, I have gone discouraged, or it's this weird thing that will happen. Let's say I hit day 11 and I'm like, sweet, I've cleared the gutters enough that I can be clear enough to write this poem and I'm happy with it. In the past, I have been tempted to stop at that point, because it's like, well, cool, I got a poem, I'm done. Part of the thing about this rise and shine in the writing every day, I set myself up to be accountable to myself and others so that I wouldn't hit that stopping point. And I'll be honest, that was part of my intention, right? But I knew I was going to hit that point where I was going to want to stop. And because in the group, I was writing past the point of a good poem, I did have that thought where the next day I was like, cool, this doesn't have to be good, but good and bad are all relative. I like to use the term that a local poet here, Leon Alvarado, actually has coined, which is low stakes. So one of the tools I use also is writing at the top of my page or just in my mind, just saying this is a low stakes poem. There's nothing at stake. It doesn't need to be good. I just need to write it. That's super freeing.
I love that idea. I try to do something similar, always being like, I'm just going to play here. I learned something new and I'm just going to try it. It's like the first time you make a recipe. You're like, yeah, I definitely want to change some things, but at least I know how to make it now. And whatever happens, happens, but at least you showed up. Maybe you could speak a little more about how, yeah, some of the poems are not going to be great, but how quickly you can get into the poems. It's funny you talked about yoga. First time I did yoga, it's like I couldn't touch my toes, I couldn't do this, but then after a while, I could slip into these poses a lot faster. So maybe you could talk about how your access to the material or productivity has changed as you have made it so habitual.
Yeah, I think of everything like practice. So just like yoga, a lot of the language is about practicing. And I think about other activities, you warm up, you cool down. In order to run a marathon, you have to run a lot. It's the act of doing, the act of creating that I try to remember is the reward in itself, without an expectation of an outcome, letting go of attachment to the outcome. I mean, quite honestly, I have not published hardly any over the last few years, letting myself let go of the literary establishment. I know that's not exactly what you asked, but to me it's relevant in the act of producing and who am I producing for? Who am I writing for? What is the point of all of this? You know?
These are questions I ask myself daily. I think that's so great. And you know, I had a friend who took rejection so personally and was like, I don't know why I'm even trying, and would become extremely sour if you even brought up writing, but they were a poet. And I was like, don't you feel happy after you've written a poem? Like, you know, when people fall in love with poetry, especially me, I work with youth. I'm not like, cool, where are you going to submit it to? You know, I'm like, oh my gosh, yes, let's talk about that feeling. And I think that we, as obviously like a consumer culture, especially in this country, we have been so attached to the product and how it's, we're going to market it and sell it versus the process and how it changes our chemistry to write these things and how we explore ourselves.
Oh yeah, I am 100% process oriented. That's what I bring into our workshops. I think as anyone who does lead a workshop, if you tell people, well, you need to write this and then it needs to be this way, you're going to create a shutdown. And I'm always about the opening. That's what we're talking about right now, I believe, is how do we get to those openings? And it's by embracing the process. I mean, so much of this is just life, right? I do see writing poetry as a facet of how to live life. Same with you, Kelly. Through the act of writing poetry, I feel like I have learned how to live my life in a way that is more true and authentic.
It's also a very Hindu concept. Like, there's a line from the Bhagavad Gita, which is the Hindu equivalent of the Bible, that's like, to you belong your actions, but not the fruits of your actions. Mm-hmm. And from the psychology of creativity as well, the research has found that the best creativity comes when people are just focusing on their process and not concerned about their product or pleasing other people. And I want to just throw in like maybe a monkey wrench here. I'm thinking about your poem, especially Nancy, and how it's so relevant to what's going on right now. I'm also wondering, do we have an obligation to share that with other people? Is publishing maybe something we do not just to satisfy our own egos, but something we do out of benevolence to other people? Or how, you know, how is your relationship, especially when you write something so politically engaged?
Yes, yeah. I'm still ready to go there with you. It has been the single most transformative question I've been asking myself. You know, I just finished my first semester of my MFA program at Antioch University. I have recently come to the conclusion, as in literally this morning, that I do have what I feel is a duty to share the things that I think will be a gift or a benefit or somehow interesting to others. I needed to go through all of this to come to my own conclusion now why I will share, why I want to share. Because I think in the past, I did have a bit of a baggage of the literary establishment in the Emerging Voices Fellowship, which was amazing. They were basically grooming us to be little literary celebrities. And I just got a little bit overwhelmed, took a few years off of publishing, really, to determine what I wanted my role in that to be. And I finally come around that, yes, I am willing and I am ready to practice in public. So for me, what that means is I'm letting go of a need for validation. I do have the goal in the long run to want to publish widely and reach people because what I believe I'm writing is something worth sharing. I'm not going to wait to send the poems out right now to a literary journal that might take 6 months. And there's this whole thing about when you publish it on your blog or on your Facebook, it's considered previously published, yada, yada, yada. I've decided I don't care. And I'm just going to start sharing my work. I literally shared this poem times like these on my own Facebook page this morning. And I've already gotten some responses. So it reminds me that writing, while it is individual during the moment of generation, once the poem is there, I feel like it does not belong to me. And with that, I am, yes, 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 I am ready and willing to share.
You know, that's so funny. To me, that sounds like a little bit of an act of either radical anarchy or maybe just radical democracy, where it's, I'm not waiting for a gatekeeper. I'm not waiting for someone else to tell me this is good enough or I'm allowed to publish. I know that this is something that needs to be spoken to other people, and I'm going to make it available for free as fast as possible. I know during this pandemic, my attitude towards poetry has shifted dramatically. Like, it's less about, I need to get my name in a big journal. It's more like, oh, good. I'm not the only one who feels that way. I'm not crazy. We're all here experiencing this together, even if we're all alone in our own houses. On the other hand, just playing devil's advocate, there's also some instances where I feel like, wow, I really wish I would sit on that poem and think about it before I let it go out in the world, let it cook, let it develop. So you really have to have your own sense of when you know it's finished.
I want to share something for listeners that my mentor at Antioch, Chen Chen, said to me. A poem is finished once it's made all of its decisions. I really love that, because as beginning writers, maybe we aren't making intentional decisions because we're just getting it out. We're just practicing, and that's great. Even not even beginning writers, like me, like all of us, like, you know, we're just writing. But the revision process is when you make an intentional decision. Yes, I'm going to keep that line. Yes, I'm going to keep that word. And I decide that this is ready to share. And so I do have that tension, which is why I have not shared a lot, because I wait until I feel like I know it's ready.
I think that you really limit your growth if you're writing something with the intent to get it in X journal every time, right? Because who knows where that poem would go if you didn't care where it got in.
I mean, I don't want to put any of those false binaries on people. Like, there are people who I think are great artists and have a stunning career. It's not that one negates the other. It's a matter of where your intention is and what you're doing this for and why you're doing this. Knowing myself as a teacher too, sometimes it's like all of my own personal writing or my personal publishing goes out the window because I'm more focused on like enrolling my classes. And sometimes what happens is I'll go months without getting anything published, but three of my students will hit one of their major goals or get a poem into a journal that they've been wanting to get into. And I have to go like, well, I can't take credit for that, but I also know that some of what I'm doing helped them towards that. You have to get rooted in what your real mission is.
Absolutely. I can relate to that. And I also segue into what my mission is, because I think that having a mission statement for your life is something I read in a book many years ago by Stephen Covey. I can't remember the title. He's got a few, but creating a mission statement for your life connects you to your center to give you a guidepost and a compass when things come your way. My mission is to see creativity flourish everywhere. That's it. That's it. If that means that for a year I'm teaching more than writing, because that's how I do that mission, okay. If that means the next year, which is where I'm at right now, I focus more on the writing and the sharing because a transformation has occurred in me, then I'll do that. If creativity flourishing everywhere is getting a nice book out into the world, yeah, I'll do that. Life is so not static. Everything is flowing all the time. Having that vision of why we're doing this, to me, is the most important thing. And whenever I feel unclear about that, I need to slow my roll and I need to remember why.
And I think that just requires so much patience and faith, which is what I'm working on right now, is just being all like, yeah, you know, we're here. There's so many ways we're limited right now and can't do some of the things I've been wanting to do, but I have to have patience that if I focus on this process, eventually it's going to lead to this other outcome. Maybe the fruits of the actions are none of my business. I can only focus on the action right now. So that just requires so much surrender.
Surrender. I'm wondering if we can switch gears a little. We try to ask poets for a revision technique. So something they specifically do to revise their work. And then Tricia and I use those revision techniques to show our members, you know, all the ways that we can play low stakes on the page. So I'm wondering if you could talk about like a tried and true technique that you use.
Yeah, the poem that I read at the top of this was the difficult poem that had a seed of an idea in it. I liked the ending. I knew that I wanted to keep the ending with the eyeball floating in the sea, but I didn't know how to get the narrative to that point. And I remember I spent 4 hours at this coffee shop working on this one poem. One of the things that I did is highlight the places in the poem that I really think are strong. So a lot of critique workshops that I had been in my early years would focus first on what needs to change. I like to focus first on what's working. So building the poem out from there, I knew I wanted this ending. I highlighted it in yellow on my Word doc, and I took the places that were working and I popped them into a new document, and I started from there to write around what was already working. Look at every single word. So what I'll do is highlight the words that I think are really strong, that I really like, that really resonate. And then the rest of the words that aren't highlighted, and I'll be like, is this the best word for this particular sentence, line or sentence or image? Is it the most refreshing image? Is it the most surprising and interesting? They say love me or hate me, but spare me your indifference. I would like to not have an indifferent reaction to a line in my poems. So if I am having that, then that's an indication for me to rework it and think back into the generative process. So the revision process for me, actually, once I realized that I didn't have to hate revision, I could see it as basically inviting the muse back. It was like she was there for the first time, and then I'm inviting her back to fill in the rest of the poem that isn't written yet.
Let me ask you a little bit more about that. From what I got, from what I understood of the poem, it sounds like it's a story of your grandfather. So I'm kind of curious. You knew when you wrote it that you liked the last line. Was there anything else from the first poem that also made it into the final draft? Or was it mainly that last line that you were working towards?
There was, I remember what happened. There was a different poem that I had written. It was basically two different poems. I mean, I'm an overwriter, so I had like a 3-page long story about my grandfather. And I just took bits of it, popped it into this one. And also, I just want to say a difficult part about writing this, for anyone who has ever experienced cultural abandonment, I found it very difficult to write about things that I did not have access to. The end of the poem is what I do know, but then the rest of it, I had to be okay with just not knowing these things, and that became the poem.
that happens a lot in workshops. Whenever somebody's bringing in a poem and it's like there's this one part that's really alive and this other part that's just feels kind of dead, and I'll ask them, what's the this or that, or why isn't that working? And they're usually like, well, I didn't know what to say about that. I didn't know what happened. My mother never talked about that. So I just kind of made it up. I'm like, oh, what if you didn't make it up? What if you talked about the not knowing? What if the not knowing, that's relevant, and you treat the not knowing as being relevant, and you can talk about that because that's where your truth is and your honesty.
Yes, yes, yes. Asking questions, letting go of the feeling that I had to abide by that old adage. I'm sure we've all heard, write what you know. I think you can also write what you don't know. Just be honest about what you don't know. It's as Chen Chen has given me permission to do recently, it's okay to write questions. Ask the questions. You don't have to have the answers. And that is a sense of truth.
So can you tell me a little bit about how you approached the writing about what you don't know? Were these like things that you had gathered from stories from other people? Just say a little bit more about that.
So I was disowned by my Chinese family at birth because my father, who is Chinese, married my mother, who is Caucasian. My grandmother was the matriarch of a large Chinese immigrant family, and this went against what she wanted. She wanted the pure blood Chinese. So I'm a mixed race person, obviously. Because I didn't know any of my history, that was the project I was working on when I wrote this poem when I was in the Penn Center. It took me a long time to realize I don't have an obligation to do years of research if I don't want to. Mm. I can just live in my own life, in my own skin, and let the absences be the absences that they are and fill in the blanks with my own life. But as to the poem and the actual writing, I did pull from what I knew. I knew that he went back to China. He actually, in the 1940s, as a Chinese man going to UCLA, he apparently had fallen in love with a white woman. This was so not heard of, but he decided not to marry her, and he went back to China in order to specifically find a Chinese bride. And that's how her whole family immigrated over to America. That's the story that I know. And then I just sort of filled in the blanks with the images, the skin, the breath, the fish. They owned a Chinese restaurant. So I just kind of filled in the blanks.
I love what you say about letting the absences be the absences. We don't have an obligation to go know everything. It's okay to not know certain things about ourselves, our past, our relatives, our family. And instead of fighting it, just letting that be okay. I mean, that's just revolutionary kind of honesty.
Wow, I love that phrase. Yeah, revolutionary honesty. Let's go there.
It's so human. I just think it's so human. Let my story be my story.
I think that's just something that I found very useful myself, is when I feel like I feel myself bullshitting myself.
Yeah, I think living with honesty is kind of a poet's job. At least I can speak for myself. I feel like my job is to live with honesty and to get clear. The idea of poets writing in images and how do we get to those images is seeing. We are allowing ourselves to see. I'm a big mystic, so I'm just going to say it. It's like clairvoyance means clear seeing.
Absolutely. I have one last question. If we want to do rise and write?
Rise and shine.
Rise and shine. If we want to do that, how can people get in touch with you? And how can they find your work in general?
So my main hub online is my website, nancylenewu.com. Lene is Lynee. Woo is Woo. So on my website, even though I don't update it all the time, I update it fairly regularly. That is the main place to find me. You can also find me on Facebook. I'm pretty loud on Facebook.
Nancy, this has been just such a beautiful conversation. I find your way of processing poetry and being able to process life through poetry so healthy. It's just so nice to have a very healthy relationship, someone who's embodying and demonstrating a healthy evolution towards writing. Thank you for embodying that and demonstrating that. That's so helpful for all of us to witness and hopefully learn from. So thank you.
Yeah, I agree. I want to like take a guru class with you in terms of like not scarcity mindset and allowing ourselves to like let the art be the art. I have learned so much, and this has been a really like freeing permission granting conversation.
Oh, Trisha, Kelly, thank you so much. I really appreciate this chance to, as I learned from a book by Jeff Goins called Real Artists Don't Starve, which is again abundance mindset, that practicing in public is a big part for me of being in the flow and being an artist. So thank you for allowing me to practice in public with you. It has been such a great conversation. Thank you. See y'all soon.
Hey, Saloncast listeners. Do you have questions you want us to ask our guests about the writing or rewriting process? Have you tried some of these rewriting strategies yourself? What new revelations did they bring?
Message us at Trisha@thepoetrysalon.com or Kelly@thepoetrysalon.com with the subject line Saloncast Listener.
Also, do you want to do a random act of kindness? How about a senseless act of beauty? Rate and review us and write a comment on this episode.
It truly helps us get heard and get seen, and it helps other poets find us in the chaotic distractions of cyberspace.
It takes less than a minute and it's totally free.
Thanks again for being part of our community.
And remember to write on, share on.
And remember, whoever writes the worst draft wins.
Yay!